from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. We're talking with Greg Proops now, a comic equally at home on stage, screen, doing stand-up, doing podcasting. He'll be performing at Punchline San Francisco tonight and tomorrow. You've seen him in so many things. If I listed them all, we'd have no more time for your questions. But we could start by talking about Whose Line Is It Anyway? Thank you so much for being here, Greg.
Of course, Rachel.
Tell us about Whose Line Is It Anyway? How did you get your start on that show?
Oh, golly. Well, I was living in San Francisco. Excuse me. I was in 1989, and I was doing a gig with a comic named Tom Kenny, who's now SpongeBob SquarePants. And we were in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and my friend Mike McShane called me and said, there's some English improv show in town auditioning. And I was so bummed out because I was trapped in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And so thank God they came back the next year and auditioned, and I got on then. And I ended up being on the English version for 10 years, and then we did it on ABC for 4 years, and now all of a sudden we're back on the CW. And this is going to be our – we're going to tape again next year, so it'll be our third year on the CW. So it's the gift that keeps on giving, even though I had no idea it was ever going to happen, and it's been complete luck in my life because it's allowed me to go around the world. I mean, I'm going to Edinburgh next week and doing – 2 weeks there with the English cast. So I'll be there with Clive Anderson and Josie and McShane and all the – people from that version.
When you encounter, you know, those three people who've lived under a rock for the last 25 years and they say, you know, what is Whose Line Is It Anyway? What do you tell them?
It's a show where old people get together and like the Antique Roadshow, and we one last time prove that we still have the energy to do this, like the Rolling Stones. It's an improv show, and we make stuff up, and we really do make it up. We don't have a script, we don't know what we're going to say. And we sing and we dance and we caper around and we act like ninnies, and it's good fun.
What's the difference between the British version and the American version?
One was shot in England.
Right.
And one was shot in America. There's more time in the English one. An English half hour is 24 minutes, I think, and an American half hour is 22 and a half minutes.
Do they like a different kind of humor, or does the same thing play well?
Well, when we did it in England, it was a little freer. There was more leeway, and we did longer form things like musicals and stuff like that. The American one, they tend to stunt cast things. They bring in people from other shows. Or on the ABC one, I remember they had Jerry Springer on and a woman like Snake Charmer. And on the CW one, they bring in all the kids from all the kids shows on CW, like Vampire Diaries and stuff. People who I have no idea who they are, but... and I think they think that helps pump it. But I never did. I always thought the real attraction is watching us balance, you know, watching
exactly.
us do the tight wire.
Just play off of whatever comes up.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't see why bringing a guest star in actually gave added value to the show. But I'm not a television executive, so I can't say that I'm as wise as them. They seem to know everything, don't they?
And
TV's in such a great state.
TV is in such a great
it's
state.
It's marvelous. So inventive.
Well, parts of it are anyway. I mean, it does seem like late night TV has bounced back, and you're on the talk show circuit a lot with people like Chelsea Lately, Craig Ferguson on the Late Late Show. I guess it's fair to say you play well with others.
I do. I can be a team player, even though my ego's huge. I can set that aside, and I can pass the ball, so I can bounce pass even.
Who do you most enjoy going on stage with for that?
Oh, well, all the Whose Line guys. I mean, I work with all of them. I work with Ryan Stiles, the tall one, Colin Mochrie, the bald one, Wayne Brady, the black guy, and all the English cast as well. So horribly, we're all still friends at this late date after 100 years. They're my best friends in England, so I like playing with all of them. As far as the talk shows go, I'd say Craig Ferguson because he really respects comedy, and I demand that from artists. I don't care if you don't like jokes or whatever, but if you're a comedian and you don't respect comedy, I can't dig it.
What does that look like when you find a comedian who doesn't respect comedy?
Well, mostly in show business. Like, the agents and managers and people who are around comedy aren't always comedy fans. You know what I mean? They could be selling anything. They could be selling cars or cans of beans.
You could be making sausage.
Yep.
They don't care.
They simply don't care. They're corporate drones who work in a giant industry, and that doesn't interest me at all. I got into this for the fun of it, and I got into it to tell jokes and to connect with people. And so that's where I'm coming from. That's why I do the podcast. I find, like radio, it's so intimate. You're speaking right to one person every time. You have to remember you're not talking to a lot of people. You're talking to one person. And I think with the podcast, it's opened up my life and my career way more than I ever would have thought stand-up would have. And I always thought stand-up was the most direct way to communicate with people. But I find that the podcast does. We had a lot of people in last night and, you know, they bring gifts and there's running gags and we have a little world and I get to dispense my liberal poison. And it's, you know, it's great fun.
It's called The Smartest Man in the World, and a few hundred thousand people have found it on places like iTunes. Why did you get into podcasting? I mean, it's not like you have an empty schedule otherwise, but what made you think, wait a moment, I want to try that?
The cats who produced the show, produced Jimmy Pardo's show and Doug Benson's show, who are very popular podcasts, and they asked me if I'd want to do one like 3 years ago. And I said, well, who will listen to it? And they want more people to listen. And then we had a discussion over what we were going to do, and everybody else has guests. So I opted not to have guests. I opted to spiel on my own and make the audience my guest by talking to them at the end. And so that's what motivated me to do it. After I did the first one, I had no idea what was going to happen. And my wife said to me, this is what you should be doing. So after that, it was an easy decision. She was like, no, this is what you're good at. It's even better than stand-up because it's improvised and you get to say what you want. And it's very personal. So that once I did it a couple of times, I was sort of hooked on it. And now I don't want to not do it.
You explore so many things on stage, on screen. I'm trying to imagine, if it's possible to do it on family radio, to explain what you can say, for instance, in a podcast that you couldn't say, in the other realms, other mediums.
Well, on a television show like Whose Line Is It Anyway, there's no time for my agenda. We're there to have fun and goof around. So I can say all the things that mean things to me. For instance, I feel like the inequity of wealth in this world is a gigantic, horrible, burning issue that is not recognized by the mainstream media. And that the abuse of women and that the way women are treated in this world is the number one problem facing the world. There is no other problem. The way women are treated is the crux of the matter. Because once women are given any respect or treated equally, then things change and then the world is better. And that's sort of my crusade, to keep repeating that a million times. Because you watch TV and they'll come on CNN or whatever news station have you and go, controversial issue today about women's reproductive. There's nothing controversial about women's reproduction at all. It's simply biological. Men have the ball. Men feel like it's controversial. Why is it not controversial to be a giant fat white guy and carry a gun into a Walmart? Why is it easier to buy guns than it is to get an abortion? To me, that's where the scandal lies.
You couldn't ad lib on.
Oh, I can ad lib
on that one,
like,
say on Craig Ferguson.
They let me talk about it a little bit. Ferguson more than anyone else. They're not very sensory. But they don't love you to talk about it on network TV. Because it really rubs them the wrong way. And what if Ford drops them? Or what if McDonald's drops them? Or what if I say something like the World Cup is a giant corporate boondoggle that's put on by enormous corporations so they can knock down poor neighborhoods? You can't say that on every show. I can say it on your show. Also, at the same time, it's also an uplifting thing that I love, and I love sport. But people have to understand there's a dichotomy to these giant events. And that people are hurt at the same time as that sport is celebrated and stuff like that. And
you've talked about all kinds of political issues involving
anybody
sports.
Laughing in there?
Anybody laughing in there? I'm seeing some chuckling visually from producer Dan Zoll. I mean,
who doesn't want to watch the World Cup when players are eating the Italian players? They're going to spoil their dinner. Go on.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you've talked about this on stage, like even with local audiences, right? Like the price of sports tickets, at a certain point, that's also political.
Oh, it's completely political. I grew up going to Candlestick Park, and my father took me to millions of games. And so I saw Willie Mays and Willie McCovey when I was a kid. And I was showing my wife, a guy gave me a Brooklyn Dodgers World Series ticket from 1955, $7.50, which was a lot of money in 1955. But now to go to a Dodgers game in Los Angeles is $150, $175 to sit down front. That's one ticket. And that's usurious. Not only that, it's obscene. And the people who own these teams are, by and large, except for the Dodgers, bilious white millionaire guys. The billionaire who owns the Giants wants to underpay all the people who work at the park where the Giants play. He doesn't want to give them a raise. He doesn't want to give them health care. And I think that's where all the inequity lies, that we let these people control the means of our entertainment. And then we complain that the athletes make too much money. Which is ridiculous because they have to put their bodies on the line and, you know, maybe they're not all warm, wonderful human beings. Nobody is. The point to me is that why should tickets be so outrageously expensive? And then if we do make it to the postseason, no child is going to be able to afford to go. When you used to literally be able to pitch up to the game 20 years ago, even 25, go to the Giants, it was $5 sitting in bleachers, $3.50.
Well, you know, if you're a bilious white millionaire guy, or even if you're not, you could choose to call in and put your questions to Greg Proops. Call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Greg Proops is also performing at the Punchline in San Francisco tonight and tomorrow night. Email us at forum@kqed and ask him about it. Or, you know, tweet. Facebook. It's all good. You mentioned that you live in L.A. now, but you did spend your formative years in San Carlos, as I understand it, doing drugs and listening to Rick James.
Well, for a brief period, I was a pizza delivery boy at Chicken Delight Pizza Man on Burlingame Avenue, which I don't believe exists anymore. There was a giant plastic chicken on top of the building holding a platter of pieces of chicken. As if it was offering you its own progeny, which I always felt was not the most delectable way to. In those days, having chicken delivered to your house was an amazing technological innovation. Now we're bored with
it. What will they think of next? Yes.
Exactly. And the guy who ran the Chicken Delight was also a drug dealer, so it made it very convenient for me as a teenager to. It was sort of. I never took any money home because I gave it all to him. But that was the 70s in the Bay Area, it was pretty. Wild time. Yeah, I went to San Carlos High School, and we would come up to San Francisco to see concerts or go to. I remember we went to Santa Cruz to see the Ramones, me and my cousin Donnie. This is in 1978. It was the Ramones and Blondie. So that was 1978. Cut to a year ago, I'm there with the Who's Line guys, and we're backstage at Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. And I say to the stage manager, I saw Blondie and the Ramones here in 1978. And she goes, that was a good show. I was like, have you been waiting here the whole time? Obviously, she'd been working there the whole time.
Well, you can see why. I mean, it's a good place to be.
It was. It was lovely. I love Santa Cruz.
When you come back here for performances, I mean, how does the Bay Area, how does it seem to you that it's changed over the years?
Well, they're doing a good job of getting rid of all the artists and poor people out of San Francisco. And that, I used to
some of them are coming to L.A. to join you.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's cheaper there. I mean, moving to the far reaches of the East Bay. I used to live on Hayes and Lyon in a place that was $150 a month, and I dare say that's not going to happen anymore. And I'll be honest, I as much as I rely on tech and podcasting is such a tech part of my world, and I deliver so much material over the phone and whatnot, I don't trust the people who own these giant tech companies to be any different than the oil magnates or the insurance captains or any giant captains of industry. When it's been revealed in the last few weeks that the makeup of Facebook and Twitter and Google and that is white people, white guys, and they lean toward
like
that.
Like yourself, you know.
I'm the first to admit I'm a middle-aged white guy, but they don't really seek diversity, and they don't really seek change. There's just lip service to that at the same time as that technology is benign, and technology is only benign when it's operated by people with good intentions. So I feel like what we have to prepare for or look out for in this world is a world where our cars are talking about where we're going to insurance companies, and our phones are telling medical companies and insurance companies what we're eating and if we're not exercising and if we're smoking and if we're taking alcohol. Because this is a world that corporations are desperate to have, where they can have every type of information on us, about us, so that they can regulate us and that they can put the hammer to us with healthcare costs. And I'm very serious when I say that. That is the world that they envision for us. Not a world of free and easy, do what you like, have some yoga. A world where, no, you drank a Coke yesterday, your rates go up. And I know it because it's on the record because I saw it off your phone.
Or you listen to a podcast from Greg Proops. We know that you're deviant. Well, you know, do you feel like you have more power or more influence because you do have this army of minions now who are listening?
Well, I don't consider them minions as much as, a mutant militia. I don't have more power. It's simply an avenue where I'm able to express myself and like I say, connect with people on a one-to-one basis. And I think that that's the part that has been so profound for me, is that people respond to it. And that there's a lot of not so much people that agree with me. I get a lot of people who write me and go, I don't agree with everything you say, but I listen to your show. And that means more to me almost than people who agree, because that's a tougher sell. And I'm always urging people to think critically and not believe the things they hear. And I say, even me, I have an agenda. We all have an agenda. Just understand that everything's agenda-driven. Don't walk around going, you know, what do they say? The average person sees 3,000 ads a day. No one even thinks about that.
Yeah.
The intrusiveness of that.
The onslaught coming at you. Think about it.
And then you watch the news or you read something on the interweb or you read a newspaper. That's an agenda, too, brought to you by another point of view. You have to be able to think for yourself. And that's the thing I think is most important.
Let's turn now to Tishan in San Jose. Hi.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Sean.
How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. And Greg, just want to let you know, I'm from India. I grew up watching Who's Lines anyway, and I just want to thank you guys for bringing that kind of a show. It was wonderful. You know, it just made life easier watching your shows in India. And, of course, I keep following you on your YouTube as well. So great job on what you guys are doing.
Thank you very much. You're watching on Star TV, huh?
Yeah, yes.
Right on.
The funny thing, I never knew which channel it was, but I just remember the program. Who's that anyway? It was a wonderful program. And I think you guys, you are my favorite, actually, honestly.
I can believe that.
Tishan, yeah. was this your first introduction to comedy?
It was my first introduction to comedy. There were not many comedy shows in India which we used to go to, and this was the only show which was total. And what was really surprising for us was it was improv, and it used to be like, you know, we used to wonder how you guys were so quick on those puns, and it was like, you know, it was a wonderful show. It kind of gave us an introduction to humor and, you know, open my mind to comedy and things like that. So
thank you
so much for doing what you did.
Thank you.
I want to express my gratitude for that.
That's very sweet of you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tishan. Andrew emails, I've loved this guy ever since, if memory serves, I heard him on the Alex Bennett Show in San Francisco, live 105. Question, does today's stand-up compare with the best of the 80s stand-up in terms of wit? Who are the thinking person's comedians today?
I think it does. I think we're in a boom period of comedy. I think one of the advantages of TV not being as important as it was is it's allowed a lot of people to rise out of the interweb world and take over that way. I love Jen Kirkman. I think Louis C.K. is a phenomenon. I love Margaret Cho from the Bay Area. I think there's a zillion for political comics. Lee Camp and Jamie Kilstein are rocking hard in New York. And even your big podcasters like your Mark Maron and whatnot. Mark Maron's a wildly intelligent and engaging individual who I think challenges the audience. And that's what I look for in comedy. I don't want to be told that the same thing is fine and that everyone's the world is the best possible world. That doesn't interest me as much as a comedian. I prefer people who kind of, you know, let you have it a little more. I don't need to be seduced, in other words.
And I think that it's fair to say that that's what a lot of listeners, viewers want. I mean, like Louis C.K. is a very challenging comic. Mm-hmm. If you're watching him and you're not being heavily disturbed, you're not paying attention.
Right. He makes you uncomfortable, and that's what I love about him. Also, he has the craft to be able to do that and still make it funny, and that's the most important thing, I think. Comics who just get up and sing and dance and shuck and jive, that's fine too. That's a whole other style of comedy. It relieves the pressure. I get it. It's just not something that, it's not my favorite kind. I always like George Carlin and Bill Hicks and Lily Tomlin and, you know.
Well, you know, since you're raising some names from the past there, I'm wondering if you can, for the benefit of people who, you know, were not here or perhaps could not legally attend some of the clubs where comedy was performed in San Francisco in the 1980s, if you could just talk about that time.
Well, it was a staggering time. Alex was so helpful to so many of us here. He really pushed forward a lot of intelligent comics. He helped me a lot, and he used to put us on stage, and going on his radio show helped us have careers. Bob Rubin, who is a very surreal comedian, one of his jokes was, my favorite comic book character was Eunice, the female wedge. She kept doors ajar in houses near the equator. I mean, it was that, what was it? I'm throwing an awards banquet for the voices in my head. He was so surreal and so metaphysical and funny. And Warren Thomas, who's passed away since but was my best friend. Warren Thomas was an amazingly scabrous and scathing comedian and really creative. We were all children of sort of Robin Williams, you know what I mean? Like, what was important in San Francisco comedy in the 80s was not to make the audience happy, but to make yourself, to satisfy yourself artistically by... There was a lot of sub-referencing. You had to have a working knowledge of literature and history. The audiences here kept you on your toes because they were so smart and attentive. And I think it spoiled me forever and ever. I don't think there's been a smarter, more focused time in my career than San Francisco in the 80s. I mean, England in the 90s was much the same because it was a boom time. Also, there were no stakes here. You'd have to go to LA to be on TV. So we were playing for each other. And I think there was a real healthy competition then. And look at the comics who've come from then that are out in the world now. Mark Mellon, Dana Gould, Doug Benson spent a lot of time here. All of whom have giant podcasts now. Janine Garofalo, I remember being here then. David Cross from Mr. Show. I was here. Even Drew Carey I met here in those days. I mean, it was a real... It was a groovy time in San Francisco. There was
a groovy time with Robin
time.
Williams as the godfather of it all.
Well, only because Robin goes so fast, and he's literate. You have to be able to follow him. I tend to go too fast, and it's a function of that. I have to remember when I get to other places that people don't go so fast. You can lay the ideas down slower.
Well, talking about other places, I mean, we've heard this giant sucking sound since the 80s. New York, London, Los Angeles pulled y'all away from the Bay Area. Can you imagine something like that? Not necessarily re-emerging, but something new emerging from the cultural foment here?
Absolutely. I think it is already. I mean, I met a comic in Montreal named Hassan, and I'm blanking on his last name. And he had just been around the world doing a documentary about comics in different countries. And I think there's loads of energy coming from here. And like I say, the access to tech makes everything a whole new ball game. We as Maren said a couple of years ago, we don't need show business anymore. We have podcasts. My only fear with that, of course, is that the FCC will get hip to what's going on and shut us down in the next few years.
Don't tell anybody. Yeah.
The government is, as you know, inconceivably backward and old-fashioned. And they really think that, you know, like the radio and the TV are the dominant. They don't get that.
Well, there is this debate over net neutrality that Mark Maron has weighed in very heavily on.
Yeah, it's a serious issue for us because the next thing they're going to do is have people coming in and listening to us. And then they'll realize that we're saying truthful things, and then they'll want to stop that. And that's my biggest concern with the net neutrality. And also forcing people to pay for the internet, which is a scandal in this country. I was in Finland this year, France, and Holland. And the internet service in Finland is extraordinarily fast. You can't imagine how fast it is. You turn on your computer, the whole movie's downloaded in 2 seconds. And it's because of the giant obstructive corporations here that they want to make you pay for bad service, which is what we get in Los Angeles. We have Comcast and Time Warner, which are heinous beyond measure.
Well, with that happy thought, let's go now to Tara in San Jose. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you. And speaking of Comcast and that, I don't have cable, but I grew up watching you in Wisconsin, so I really do appreciate your humor. It is truly a breath of fresh air, and to hear everything that you were saying and how we don't speak about women's productive rights and everything, I completely appreciate everything you're saying. I watched a comedy show, I'll just say it. It's a reality comedy show that's on now last night, and it's nothing like everything that you're saying, and I just really wish that there were more people in this world like you. And we have this little place called the Improv in San Jose, so you should really come because I would definitely pay to come see you. You are now my new favorite
comedian. Well, thank you. You're so kind. I played there this year in May because I went to the Giants game and then I took the train back down. It's a really lovely comedy club, the Improv in San Jose. It's an old-time theater, and it's in the old neighborhood right you know, downtown San Jose, right next to the Mission and the City Hall and the museums and all that. So it's great fun down there. Well, come up and see me in San Francisco at the Punchline, too. Yeah, I know. That's the thing about these network TV shows. It's a, you know, it's a world where women are nags and girlfriends are fat and that, all the stuff we thought was dead in the 50s, it's still alive and they keep it going and it's kind of boring.
I suppose. I mean, then again, between Netflix, between cable, between the interwebs, like it's hard to imagine. If you don't want to be abused, exposed to that, you don't have to be.
No, you don't have to be. But some people don't. You know, the other fact of America is some people don't have anything but the television. They really don't have a phone and they don't have a computer. I know it's hard for people in the Bay Area to get their mind around, but there is such a thing as an underclass, and they do watch television all the time, and that's where they get their information from. And so it's important to sort of reach out to them as well. Not everybody has a fancy phone. That's a difficult thing for people to understand in the Bay Area.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people in the Bay Area are aware, you know, rich and poor is happening here too.
Oh, yes.
Right? Economic inequities. Do you find when you come up here that what the audience wants to hear from you is different? And I'm not just talking about baseball where they expect you to discuss the Giants and the A's. But, you know, like, are there things that make the local audiences, you know, like, I got to hit this point and that point when you come up here?
Well, I mean, I was I was baptized in this agenda up here. So I'm poisoned for the regular world till the end of time. Growing up in the Bay Area and living in San Francisco as long as I did, I'm never in step with the mainstream. No matter what happens, it's not lefty enough for me or progressive enough. I think I'm already speaking from the heart to the people. I don't actually have to think too much about what topics I'm going to cover. Fear of a corporate planet and equal rights for everyone seem to be a big winner everywhere I go. And I get a lot of response for it. People say, thank you for talking about it, because people don't want to talk about it, or it's not something that's so popular to talk about. I mean, I'm talking about like everyday sexism. The idea that there's not a woman in the world who hasn't been walking down the street with a do-rag on and a basket of laundry and had a guy drive by and say something awful to her. And this simply doesn't happen to men on the same level. And to get men to understand that that's the kind of world that women live in a good deal of the time. And that seems to be a real difficult jump for a lot of people to make. They're like, really? Does that really happen? And you're like... And also, I'm kind of over the empathy thing of think of your mother, your sister, your wife. I think, what would you do?
Yeah.
Do you really need to make it that abstract?
Put yourself in that person's shoes.
How about empathy?
Well, Tara, thank you. I wanted to get one last call in here from Wayne in San Mateo.
Hey there.
Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Greg. It's been a long time.
What's up, brother?
You probably don't remember me, but I actually directed you in a scene at San Francisco State.
Wow. Was it The Bear?
Yeah.
No.
What?
Which play was it?
It was Lone Star.
Oh, golly, yeah. How are you, buddy?
Yeah, I'm doing great. It's great to hear about your great success. It's like I've been watching your career over many, many years, and I'm not quite sure. Are we still allowed to call ourselves middle-aged?
If we're middle-aged, I'm going to live to be 108 years old, so it's awesome.
Okay, then I am too. That's great. I just wanted to congratulate you on your success and let you know that there are still people out there from San Francisco State thinking of you.
Thank you, brother.
Do you ever keep track with Michael McShane?
Yeah, I'm
gonna Wayne, I'm going to stop you there just because we're about to end the
turning
show.
Turning into old school.
Exactly.
See Mike next week in Edinburgh.
Yeah, let's continue this offline, and I guess Wayne is possibly angling for some free tickets for your performance tonight at Punchline San Francisco and tomorrow night. And we just to remind everybody, you have been listening to the comic stylings of Greg Proops, a stand-up comedian extraordinaire and host of the podcast The Smartest Man in the World, as well as a cast member of Whose Line Is It Anyway on the CW Network. Greg Proops, what a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Continue the conversation online. You'll find us at kqed.org. You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.